Hey Disruptors, with the summer upon us in the Northern Hemisphere, the Digital Disruptor team are taking a well-earned break. But we didn't want to leave you without your weekly fix of the podcast. So what have we got in store? Well, here at Digital Disruptor, we pride ourselves on bringing you the conversations just as they happened, with as little editing as possible. The thing is, every now and again, we discuss things after the show we wished had made it into the episode. However, as luck or planning would have it, we always keep the recording going, even after the show has formally wrapped. So today we're going to take a look back at some of my favourite guests and episodes over the last few months. And if you didn't catch the original episodes, it might even be a great reminder to go back and take a listen. First up in January, I spoke with Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street editor, Spencer Jacob, about the GameStop fiasco he described in his book on the topic, which was The Revolution That Wasn't, GameStop, Reddit, and the Fleecing of Small Investors. Here's the rest of our conversation on the state of crypto.
I mentioned I have three sons, so my oldest boy, I mean, he doesn't work, he doesn't do any of this stuff, but he's a computer programmer, and he writes software for a credit derivatives fund, and he has a friend who's a very clever boy too, who works for a fund that he writes algorithms for, a fund that trades cryptocurrency. It's like they make so much money. I see this kid around town. Is that they make so much money? They, without taking any risk. I mean, they're basically, you think that you're sort of leaving money on the table. You're leaving fractions of a penny on the table each time you trade stocks. But you're leaving dollar bills on the table when you trade crypto, and somebody's making that money. I mean, it's not going to money heaven. It's going to these guys. This guy that he works for is making so much money. I mean, he's a multi-billionaire already, and he's making so much money because it's just like lambs led to the slaughter. I mean, it's
one of the businesses that I'm a director and shareholder in was involved in throwing an end of year party for a crypto firm, funnily enough. And as it was coming up to the party, I think the ask hadn't quite fallen out of Bitcoin, but it certainly dropped by about 25% at that point in time. And obviously it's dropped another 25 points still since. I remember talking to the other directors, and I said, and it was quite a big, expensive party. And so it was material to the end of year results. And I just said, is this still going ahead? They just turned to me, one of the people close to the client turned to me and went, they're not investing in crypto. They're a crypto broker. They make money whether it's going up or going down. They're always making money. So long as people are trading, whether they're buying or selling, doesn't really matter. So long as there's market activity, which was I think pertinent to what you were talking about. It was that light bulb. But I remember having a very interesting conversation, funnily enough, with another journalist a couple of weeks ago who was on this show. You'll be able to work out who it was. And after we finished, I just said, look, I've got to be honest with you. I still don't understand this excitement about Bitcoin. And I said, I'm a techie. I totally get what, the concept of blockchain and effectively non-repudiable, audit trails and all of that good stuff and the idea of digital uniqueness. But the barrier to their entry for me to create a derivative coin that is also unique of my own, asymptotic to zero, right? It's literally a couple of lines of code and away we go. So there is no true scarcity. The scarcity of Bitcoin, but I could create a competitor to Bitcoin, as so many people have, tomorrow, which means there is no real scarcity. It's no more scarce than any other number I write down, of which there is an infinite number. And I said more to the point, I'm sitting there thinking there are any number of things that are literally more scarce. Like I keep saying, Steve Jobs made 50,000 of those little Next cubes. If you remember those little black things he created when he in between his Apple years. There are 50,000, there's 18 million Bitcoin. There are less of those computers that were made that are physical objects you could own and carry around. So scarcity itself can't be the thing, or you'd find other things that were scarce. So it literally, to my mind, defies all logic. And her response to me was, it's worth money because people say it's worth money. And I'm like, but surely the inverse of that applies. The minute people no longer say it's worth money, it's also worth nothing. And it has no utility because let's face it, at least I could use something else as a doorstop.
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book about that. I wish that I could have written a whole book about it. But
You will.
Maybe I will. I mean, if the hate mail doesn't get me down too much, that my book doesn't have a 1-star rating on Amazon and no publisher, whatever. But so there's a danger. There are many dangers there. Obviously, dangerous to the last person who gets, because it's a greater fool theory, right? I mean, that only works in
the Dutch tulip craze. Literally, the Dutch tulip craze.
Yeah.
that were worth money. I think there was a, like, literally there was 24 hours between these bulbs being worth $50,000 a piece and nothing the day after. It was not like there was this slow decline. It was people woke up one morning and went, why are we doing this?
Yeah. Yeah. Those total Emperor's New Clothes type kind of scales falling from their eyes. I think a Semper Augustus bulb at one point was worth as much as a house in Amsterdam. That's still standing today. So,
you know. The house is there. The bulb is gone.
Yeah. I think that aside from that danger, which is pretty obvious to me, obviously, if you sold and you got out, you know, then fine, you know, but if you're cynical about it, a lot of people I spoke with actually who traded these meme stocks were pretty cynical about them, but they, and they wound up, you know, losing money, but they sort of, they didn't want to stick it to the man. They just saw a bubble and they just got in too late, as most people do. But the other danger is that if something is just worth what you say it is, if that's what the securities markets go to. So Bitcoin is, and cryptocurrencies are one thing. People are going to learn their lesson. But if that pervades securities markets, and it has to a large extent, then that does a lot more damage, because the securities markets at the end of the day are a way for companies to say, we need to raise money, right? This company A that makes boring old widgets and this company B that captured your interest. And if company B can raise money at a tenth of the cost of company A per dollar of its profits or revenue, then that messes things up, right? Money is misallocated to company B from company A. Company A is starved of money. The company A might be the next Apple or whatever, the next Hewlett Packard, and be starved and die on the vine because it relies on these markets and it has to pay, because the flip side of valuation is the cost of money, right? It's just invert the equation, right? And so if equity capital is expensive for A and super cheap for B, then money will flow to B. And it's distorted. And if the A's of the world, you know, if this goes on for a long time and people just become accustomed to sort of the greater fool theory way of thinking, and that becomes the norm in financial markets, then bad things happen. It's not just that they lose money, but the society and business suffer, right? It's, financial markets are a serious thing.
Yeah. And look, I'm a big fan of The Economist. I read it every week religiously. By that, I mean I put on like a Pope outfit and read it in a frock. But in all seriousness, you know, their treatise, their approach, their perspective on short sellers is this, that they're, oh, I mean, I don't know if they'd use these words exactly, but they're basically a necessary evil. Their job is to sniff out overvalued organizations, to develop a thesis on it. They get it wrong probably more often than they get it right. But their job is to say, look, I think the emperor's swimming naked. And, you know, I'm prepared to put money on the table that says when the tide goes out, you're going to see his naughty bits.
And the fact that they got beaten up in this really, really hurts. It hurts the individual the most. That's the crazy thing, is that these individuals kind of ganged up on these short sellers. And short sellers are not angels, but their existence is important to your success. They provide liquidity to markets. But they also, there has to be some skeptical voice. There has to be some way to bet against things. You can't just have, I'm going to bet on things and you're not going to bet on something. By sitting out and you're not betting against something, you actually have to have somebody who's going to sell something without owning it, to take that risk, to call BS on things, right? And if they're crippled, and that's ironically, that's the regulation that might come out of this, is stricter rules on short selling, which is bonkers. It's like, you know, sort of, you know, you kind of, these people have been bloodied and left on the street, and then you come and like sort of then arrest them, you know.
Look, I mean, I think if there are any restrictions on these sorts of things, they're the ones that already exist in place, which is obviously making up false financial information to, you know, start rumors effectively to drive a share price in one direction or the other. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what should be illegal. Making stuff up, going, this thing's going to go to the moon, especially if you're putting some sort of narrative behind it, which is not based in fact. That is the thing that, any more than shouting fire in a crowded theater when there isn't one, should be basically what it is. It's not free speech. It's you're willfully causing mayhem, and that's just not right. So you look, it's an interesting environment we live in. And again, look, I'm all about free speech and liberty, and, you know, I'm a big believer that we have a right to self-determination. But I also recognize that with great power comes great responsibility, and not everybody's prepared to play by those rules, because it usually is the bad actors who are the ones who are going to do something stupid in a crowded theater.
Yeah. No, I agree. And in short, I mean, obviously, those I get contact. There's sleazy short sellers out there. There's a lot of sleazy stock promoters out there. A lot more of those.
Have you ever bought a used car? Right. Some of them are great, and some of them will tell you that the car's perfect and has got no problems with it, and they'll try and talk you up and get you to spend more than you should. I mean, there's always going to be, as you say, follow the money. What's the motivation of the individual?
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Spencer, just really, really enjoyed it. I'm glad that you'd read this book. As I said, it was one of those ones for me.
It's great.
Such a fun read, and it's good to have that in common with you. And look, I literally hope you have a great run with this book. I'm a fan of Schiller as well, Rational Exuberance. I mean, that maybe it's just my darker side, but I tend to think that what's one of my sayings in business is failure's not an option. It's an inevitability. So it's just a question of figuring out where and when and having a plan for it, because, you know, no one's ever repealed the laws of gravity, to paraphrase your Isaac Newton reference earlier on.
Oh, totally.
Good stuff. All right, my friend. Godspeed. Good luck with the book.
Whilst we're on the topic and topical topic of cryptocurrency, I had the pleasure of chatting with the host of the incredibly popular, I think it's like 14 million plus downloads, podcast Unchained, Laura Shin. For those of you not familiar with her work, she's a former senior editor at Forbes, turned independent writer, crypto journalist, and podcaster. Laura speaks passionately about cryptocurrency. Here's the rest of our conversation after we wrap.
I've got to ask the question. I mean, with some of these meme currencies, Dogecoin, et cetera, thoughts, just reaction, I'm curious.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's dispiriting. It's dispiriting because they're really serious and interesting projects that are being built that I really do think will change the world and already have changed the world, you know? And so to see people like do you ever listen to The Daily podcast put out by the New York Times?
Yeah.
Oh, did you listen to the one, the Dogecoin guy? The Dogecoin millionaire. Oh my God, you have to listen to the Dogecoin. So what they did was they interviewed him back during the initial run up in, I forget, May or June or whatever month that was. And he had been like, he was born in, you know, in a poor household and whatever. And he got into Wall Street bets and saw people talking about Dogecoin. So he put in literally all of his life savings into Dogecoin. And it eventually became $2.6 million or something like that. But now it's like $700,000. And they checked in with him last week, like during the, you know, that kind of dead week between Christmas and New Year's, they revisit their favorite episodes, and they checked in with him. And he was just like, yeah, no, I haven't sold. And, you know, I still think blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know. And I was just like, oh my God, like you totally should have sold at $2.6 million or anywhere on the way up, you know? but then he, it turns out that his new thing is Flocky. Do you know what Flocky is?
No.
Okay. So, you know, the Shiba, you know, for Dogecoin?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So Elon Musk has a Shiba Inu and its name is Flocky. So there's some coin out there named Flocky, and this guy, his new thing is Flocky. And I was just like, oh my God, like, did you not learn anything? But no, clearly he didn't. And, you know, I mean, this is just, you know, he really thinks Dogecoin is going to be the future of currency, blah, blah, blah. And it's like,
oh my God.
Don't you know that the creators of that abandoned Dogecoin? I mean, granted, okay, so now apparently there are some developers, but like, there's this report that Electric Capital does every year where they look at the open source communities around these different coins. And the one released today, it has like all the top developer communities. And it's like Ethereum, Polkadot was second, Cosmos was third, Solana was fourth, and then fifth was Bitcoin. And I don't know where Dogecoin and Flocky are, but I'm sure they're very low in terms of developer activity. And it's what I was saying before about how the developers, you know, in my book, the theme was like, you see the developers and the finance people, they kind of keep fighting and the developers always win. And like, I really feel like that's what this revolution is going to be. Yeah, it's really just going to be about the technology, you know, what actually works and accomplishes something. And yeah, at the moment, I would not bet on the developers of Dogecoin or Flocky. So, yeah, I have to
admit, the minute I saw that stuff, and, you know, I do kick myself sometimes because I don't buy them. I look at them and just think that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But I also, to be fair, I think TikTok is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. So I'm not the best investor in the world when it comes to picking trends. But I just look at this and think, like, literally the transactional cost of forking a new coin, the marginal cost is asymptotic to zero. Economic law says if the marginal cost of producing the next thing is zero, it'll generally trend to zero, right? So why the hell would anyone value this? It just defies all logic. And then you see, you know, as you say, there's a flocky, good Lord, seriously.
I know. Yeah. But, you know, one other thing I would add about that is that in general, this past year, we saw that Elon Musk kept tweeting and moving markets with his tweets. Mm-hmm. And a part of me is just like, anybody who is making their investment decisions based off a tweet by Elon Musk, like, they don't know what they're doing. Like,
well, yeah.
So let's say that you had believed in something, you felt that, you know, it was an investment worth putting your money into, and then later Elon Musk tweets something negative about it. Does that change the fundamentals of the investment that you did your research on? No, it does not. You know, unless he's revealing some news about those fundamentals. And so, you know, or vice versa, if you either did not do any research on it and suddenly you see tweets about it, you know, does that, like without having done any more research into the fundamentals, do you have enough knowledge to know whether or not you should be buying that coin? You do not. So, frankly,
if I was to challenge you on that, I would argue that Bitcoin's price has, in my personal humble opinion, has nothing to do with its scarcity, has everything to do with the Mona Lisa effect. Why is the Mona Lisa famous? Mona Lisa is famous because it's famous. In fact, it's famous because it got stolen once. It was a completely anonymous Michelangelo painting. No one cared about it. It got stolen. It became famous. It basically got Elon tweeted. And suddenly everyone thinks the Mona Lisa is this masterwork. It's a decent Michelangelo. It's not his best work by far. I feel like Bitcoin's kind of become famous for being famous. It's worth what it's worth because people think it's worth something. But to my mind, it's just a giant Yap Island to coin. That one's the big one that does. Ethereum makes complete sense to me. Absolute 110% sense. It has utility. It can be applied to do things. The smart contracts that are effectively tamper-proof make it valuable, as you say, for producing authoritative versions of anything, which is brilliant. I just look at Bitcoin and go, this just seems like it's just a pets.com. I don't understand it. It has no actual utility, and the scarcity means nothing to me. That's my personal take.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely feel like the digital gold narrative it works, and that's why people have been buying it, and that's why institutions are buying it. Because, I mean, look, here in the US, in terms of the inflation that we've had in the last almost 2 years, I mean, definitely, I would say there's an appeal there, and there's a reason why people invest in gold. And now there's a reason why people will be investing in digital gold. And is it a more narrow reason than people will buy ETH? Yeah, for sure. But is it still, does it have its own, you know, reason? Yes. And we're seeing, you know, a lot of companies buying it, you know, a lot of people. I mean, they're like, I will just tell you right now, you know,
used for something. I mean, gold at least has a use outside of it's a store of value, but it has practical purposes. It's one of the world's best.
Yeah, but Bitcoin's use is store of value.
Yeah, but that's not a use. That's an Excel spreadsheet.
Why is that not a use?
Why is it not a use? I guess it's a good question.
That's what people are using it for.
Yeah, but does not have utility in and of itself, whereas gold has a utility, right?
Oh, it does. It does. I mean, think about that. Like, why do people invest in real estate and not live in those apartments or houses or whatever?
You can earn rent from real estate. You can make it productive.
No, they do it because they later can sell it at a higher price. It's a place to park your money, and it will, the value of that will grow over time. And then later, if you want to sell it, then you can sell it at a higher price. That's literally, think about Bitcoin this way. You love New York. You love Manhattan. I love Manhattan. One of the reasons why Manhattan real estate is the most, is some of the most expensive real estate in the world is because Manhattan is an island. There's only so much real estate you can have on there. And so when you divvy up this valuable piece of real estate and more people want pieces of it, each of those pieces will become more expensive. And that's what, so people, when they buy into Bitcoin as a hedge against inflation or as digital gold, it's like people who buy their, you know, high in the skies apartments that they don't even live in, these Russian oligarchs or whatever they're doing. And they don't even live in, what they're doing is they are finding a way to store their money in a way where the value of that money will increase later. It will be greater than when they put it in. And that is exactly what people in Bitcoin are doing.
All right. I you probably need to go. I'd love to debate this with you a little longer because I feel as though the difference is I can charge rent on a property, which gives, even if I'm not charging.
I don't think they're renting them out. These Russian oligarchs, they're not renting it out.
Bear with me for a second. But in Manhattan, if you could stop, if no one had to pay rent on the whole block of Manhattan for the next 100 years, even 50 years, then people would look at it and go, well, I can't make money out of, if I put $50 million in there, I'm not going to make more money out of that particular block of land because there is no income for all of Manhattan anymore. So the fact that I might not be charging rent for that block of land I've got, but someone else is renting their apartment, someone else is renting their apartment, and it creeps up with, say, inflation every year, 5, 10% a year, that the discounted future value of that money is whatever it is, and therefore my property is worth, it's like a PE argument, right? So my property in 20 years' time is worth whatever the income of that is times, so, okay.
I think if people believed that in 150 years, Manhattan real estate would still be valuable, then they would think this is a good place for me to store money to pass on to the next generation.
Yeah.
Because the value of that asset will still be, will probably be greater, assuming that demand again increases and supply, you know, can't keep up. And it's the same with Bitcoin. That's exactly what's happening.
Yeah, I just, okay. As you can tell, I'm skeptical on that one. I feel as though it's,
I mean, you know, it doesn't even matter because look at what's happened.
Oh yeah.
Like, how else do you explain how the value of Bitcoin has risen? Yeah. There's no other way to explain it, but that is the reason people tell me that they're buying the Bitcoin. And we can see it reflected in the price. The price would not go up in that way over, 13 years.
Yeah,
think about that. From zero, and even less, because it didn't even have a price until, what was that year? I forget, 2010.
Yeah,
so, 2012. You know, I mean, yeah, they're like, that's the reason people are doing it. That's what they say. That's what that's the reason they give for why they're doing it. And we are seeing that the price has gone up too. So,
yeah, it feels like it's a bit of Robin Hood, right? It's like it's rising. So it's rising. So people jump in because they don't want this fear of missing out. And it's sort of, you know, it's a bubble. It's like it's the Dutch tulip bubble. Again, I kind of look at it and go, it went crazy. It's a store of value. Buy tulip bulbs. It's a store of value. And then at some point in time, they stop being a store of value. And it was literally overnight.
Finally, in recognition of finding some work-life balance over the summer, it reminded me of my chat with noted expert on the topic of employee productivity and burnout, Rob Cross, who's the professor of global leadership at Babson College and author of Beyond Collaboration Overload, How to Work Smarter, Get Ahead and Restore Your Well-being. It's a great book. I just finished reading it before the show recorded and our conversation continued after the episode wrapped.
Of dispersion into both business and personal lives to come to grips with it, it's hardly surprising to me that we're making a hash of how we're using it at the moment. Because I think we're on, you know, this sort of, if you want to talk about this move fast and break things, we're sort of on iteration, I'd say maybe 5 or 10 in terms of organizational structure and modalities. We're not even close to what this thing's going to look like 20 years from now, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, I agree. Like and just given what I study, I feel like I'm in just a great time, great place. But I, you know, I see.
Yeah, I think you're the modern Drucker, in my opinion. You're looking at, you know, no, and I mean that with all love and respect, because I think he had plenty of time to study something that had largely become static for the better part of, as I said, a couple of centuries. You're trying to look at something that's changing as you're measuring it.
Yeah, and I think that as we go, like I have this image in my mind that's more like an amoeba, you know, but in a network form where, you know, the work that's getting done, we have different programs of work, but the one that is at a team level, these groups have to be responsive to each other, you know what I mean? And to the fact that they're being pulled in five different directions today. And we don't really have good approaches for that yet. I'm thinking more mid-level organizational stuff than design right now, but we've got to figure that out, you know, because otherwise it's going to be a big deal. So anyway, you've got about eight thoughts going through my head, but it's, you know, I do think it's like a completely different paradigm, certainly at the organizational level, certainly as we think about, you know, what an organization is and what it does for the employees, but also in terms of execution, you know, and how these groups are working together and off of each other in a way that people can survive. So it'll be fascinating.
No, it will be. And I was thinking, as we were talking, I'd almost love to get, whether it's Gene or Jez from the software development world, on with you to talk about it. Because, you know, a lot of Gene's work around DevOps, and I don't know if you've read the Phoenix Project or any of Gene's work and research around it. Gene is a wonderful, wonderful former chief technology officer who is just fascinated by work and knowledge work in particular. And just, he's not a researcher by trade, but my God, he's a researcher by practice. And he's dedicated his life since he basically got, you know, a big check when his company got bought and just decided to invest his time and energy into studying this stuff, went to Toyota production school, got his CADA certificates and all of the hoo-ha that goes with it, and continues to do all of this amazing. No, he really invests a ton of time in understanding how high performers work. He works with a lady by the name of Dr. Nicole Forsman, who does a lot of quantitative analysis, patterns of behavior of high-performing software development teams and the organizations they live inside, which led him to look at, oh gosh, what's the name of, there's a researcher who studied the way doctors work and hospitals work. I wish I could remember his name. It's on the tip of my tongue. As soon as I hang up, I'll actually have his research over here. Yeah. You probably know who I'm talking about. But
there's a woman named Amy Edmondson that's done a lot around that with psychological safety and understanding teams. So I work with her a decent amount, but I'm sure there's others as well. You know,
I guess my point is I'd love to maybe have a deeper conversation about this, about things like high performing, about high trust cultures. Well, actually, maybe we just focus on that as a topic, because I do feel like that is one of those areas at the moment that is a hidden competency for people who do it well, and it's a hidden inhibitor for the people who are doing a bad job of it. I don't think they understand just quite how profound an impact high or low trust cultures can have on organizations and then how to obviously solve for that problem. Because one of the reasons why, funnily enough, I think it was actually our former CEO, Carly Fiorina at the time, said, I think one of the leaders made an observation. Well, Mark Hurd famously said, matrices are the death of an organization. So he got rid of all of that. But was it a lot of the reason that HP as a company, for example, over-collaborated and was a consensus culture is because no one really trusted anyone to get anything done. And therefore, the collaboration was a subconscious response to being a low-trust culture, is I need to watch you work and you need to watch me work and we need to meet and talk about the work all the time.
Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoyed a little look behind the curtains at the podcast, and I hope it inspires you to look back at some of our earlier episodes if you've just started listening. Digital Disrupted will be celebrating our 100th birthday soon, so be on the lookout for special episodes, amazing guests, and more of what I like to think is thoughtful content coming your way. Thank you again to Rocket Software for sponsoring another episode of Digital Disrupted. They've been with us from the start, and thanks to you for tuning in. If you like what you've been hearing, drop us a like and make sure to subscribe. With that, stay disruptive, everyone.